Coming up on Liberalism in Question.
So how do we amend this so that we can create a system in which there isn't any kind of exploitation, where everybody gets to be free?
Enjoy the show and be sure to follow and subscribe.
I'm Rob Forsyth and this is Liberalism in Question. Is the West declining? Do we have to face significant change to survive? Does liberalism have a future? I'm joined by Daily Telegraph's UK correspondent, Sherelle Jacobs. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're working on a book.
Yes.
About the theme of Western decline and possibilities for rejuvenation. Haven't the West been talking about decline for hundreds of years?
Yes, and you can trace that even back to previous iterations of Western civilization. So Rome was always obsessed with the fact it was in decline and the through to the empire.
It once collapsed. I guess if you keep saying it long enough, it'll come true.
Yes. And even it's quite interesting how they thought about their destruction of Carthage and how that informed their fear that actually what happened to Carthage would happen to them. And you wonder if there's a parallel now with the West since the fall of the Soviet Union, and whether we look at that and wonder, how much longer will we collapse in the same way that the Soviet Union collapsed?
Why are you concerned, Sherelle, with the possibility of the West decline at the moment?
I do feel like we have reached a tipping point. We talk about tipping points in terms of the environment, but I wonder if there's something to be said in terms of freedom. Because if you look at the way things are going, after a golden era where freedom was expanding quite consistently, I would say, over the period of about 200 years in the West, what started to happen is that things are shifting. And we've had, at least since the turn of the millennium, a relentless shrinking of freedom.
So you
almost see any index that you can try and find, whether it is intellectual freedom or freedom to demonstrate or economic freedom, these are all in decline and have been for some time. And so this is quite an interesting question. Is this actually quite a historic moment where the secret source of the West, which was arguably freedom, which made it a great civilization, is actually declining, and therefore the foundations upon which the West had maintained its edge is now receding, and what the implications of that? I think that's really, really fascinating. And this question about whether we're at a crossroads now, because people increasingly think that the answer to the unprecedented challenges that we face, or maybe the different kind of challenges we face today than we faced before, is more security rather than more freedom.
So you're saying that since the 19th and 20th centuries was with bumps in it.
Yeah.
And move to freedom, but now you think that may be coming to an end.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll give you a counter example: the 1920s and 1930s in the West.
Yeah,
there was the kind of freedom there,
anxiety,
and the call. I mean, it looked pretty grim.
Yes.
First half of the 20th century, second half.
Yeah.
Why isn't today?
That's an interesting
what's different
question.
From that one?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it's democracy is different, and I think that people's expectations are a very powerful force now in forming what happens. And so there's a level of expectation of a minimum amount of security that everyone should be guaranteed to have. There's a minimum amount of welfare that people should be entitled to. And then there's a discrepancy between expectations and the reality of what the system can offer. And that therefore that leads a kind of populism, which in the end may end up rejecting sort of the freedom-based ideas or policies or philosophies that were previously seen to be the foundation of Western societies. So I think that is something that's quite interesting and that's quite potentially new.
Let me come back to the question of security. Yeah. Just for a minute, talk about the secret source, as you put it.
Yeah.
Freedom within the context of rule of law, it's not just freedom itself. You can unpack a further the kind of freedom that you think has been so good for the growth of the West. What do you mean by this freedom?
I would say freedom to be heretical, actually.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of thought. So, for example, that the Reformation and the ability to question the Catholic Church in turn led to quite interesting ideas that challenged Christian orthodoxies. And Francis Bacon being a really good example on this idea that you could get back to Eden, that the fall wasn't permanent, that you could do this through discovery and also this new convergence between from merchant capitalist ideas about experimentation, but also science. And this was very tremendously important for unlocking the kind of innovations that unleashed the Industrial Revolution. So ideas are extremely important in how you think about things from even the very basic foundations that you need very foundational intellectual breakthroughs. How freedom is
based. So freedom of thought, any other kind of freedom as well to make it work?
Yeah, freedom of trade as well.
Right, so economic
freedom. Yeah, economic freedom freedoms. Has been extremely important. Yes. I see that those two have been the most important.
Was there a moral underpinning of this?
I would say that the idea that people were free to question orthodoxies, I'm not sure whether that's a moral thing, but there's an idea that people have a right to explore new ideas, and sort of this idea of personal autonomy.
I was thinking of
important.
I was thinking of some confidence underlay that about respect for each other, a certain common respect for humanity, and so forth, without which freedom can become chaotic.
Yeah, there's an interesting actually Whig philosopher, Third Earl of Shaftesbury, and he had a very interesting idea of liberty as politeness and this free exchange.
How very English!
Very English, but just this idea that. Where people being able to interact with each other and exchange ideas, even if they grate against each other, polishing each other around the edges.
I mean, that implies a respect.
Yeah, exactly.
An acknowledgement of the other.
Yeah.
Which is a moral confidence in it, that rather than, my God, if we disagree, the world's going to fall apart.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you said you're worried about this today because of, and you've twice said to me, worry about security. Unpack that. What's the worry about security you think is going on?
My worry is that we increasingly think that security is the answer to the problems that we face. So, for example, lockdowns is a classic example.
The lockdowns, because, the unnecessary lockdowns.
Because, if you have a pandemic, which is potentially dangerous, that when there are lives at risk, then you've got to be willing to use very blunt instruments and to suspend freedoms, even if it's just for an emergency. And then obviously that enters into questions about how you define that emergency and who gets to decide.
Oh yes,
the parameters of that emergency.
But Cheryl, that came out of with a rational, irrational fear. It was fear that caused people to accept in many countries quite illiberal positions by the government. So you think the West is getting more fearful? Is that your concern? Why we're clinging for security?
Yes, I think so. And I think 24-hour news media doesn't help either. And I think that also our expectations, which is a great thing, our expectations of having a long and healthy life are such that if anything threatens that, then that is something that people feel very, very viscerally about trying to combat and preempt. And another good example, of course, is net zero and the idea of another super catastrophic risk that we face, and that if it is necessary, then we should be willing to socially engineer people's behaviours, to enforce measures which might be seen as punitive in terms of taxation in order to fund socialistic projects, I guess, in terms of subsidies to green industry. So it's about threat elimination rather than thinking about, counterintuitively, is actually more freedom in the system going to actually give us more security? And that's something I'm quite interested in.
You mentioned, and I think this makes sense to me, social media means catastrophism is always defined.
Yeah.
Bad news travels quickly. Good news.
Yeah.
So people feel bad. Two, expectations have risen, so more things count as bad news.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In terms of what people put up with, I volunteer on a restored 19th century tall ship, you know, that used to go around the world. And when you consider what life was like as a sailor in the 1880s,
yeah,
compared to the, and it's a good improvement today. What people have to wear for safety, you realise that there was a risk acceptance that today is being reduced. Just to compare the 100 years since then, you also mentioned a fear of catastrophe in the sense of climate catastrophe.
Yeah, yeah, and this actually speaks to our. There is a kind of psychological aspect to this in that we do believe that the world is going to end somehow. And it's sort of almost the Christian tradition of the last book of Revelation. I think that there is there's something underlying in our society that we fear the end of days. And so that, I think that's maybe a reason why it's captured so many people's.
Yes, it may. That narrative is still working in our Western culture, with the Christian narrative for the return, end of days.
Yeah.
Although, am I right? It's without the compensating Christian hope that.
That would exist
in the Christian. That's right. Yeah. So it's the bad news of the Christian faith.
Yeah, without the good news. Yeah.
It's rather depressing, but.
Yeah.
And what this is causing you fear is a less confidence in freedom and openness, which itself may not be a good thing, but will have the effect of what? What would the effect long term of that secret source going off?
Yeah. So just if we think about pandemics, I'm just fascinated with Sweden and how Sweden managed, despite not locking down, to have some of the lowest death rates in Europe. And in Sweden, they do have this not just a radical sense of individualism, but it's complemented by this radical sense of responsibility to the collective. And so
people can
be trusted to do what is
so right. There was a cultural strength in, you believe, in Sweden to do with the community. My point about trust and openness.
Yes.
Is Sweden a very homogeneous country?
I suppose, in comparison.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether you're.
There is the Swedish exceptionalism, so it has been open to migration in recent years, and we've seen a bit of a reaction against.
Well, can I ask about that? Because you served in Tunisia, your degrees in African as well as European studies. You're aware of some of the issues. Now, immigration is not new to the world, and disruptive immigration.
Yeah.
Part of why the Roman Empire.
Yes.
Thanks for my say so.
Yeah.
But, immigration, and not just immigration, but immigration from societies in which there is violence and religious violence. I'm thinking about Islamism. The time of recording, we're still reacting after the Hamas attack on Israel, and we don't know at this stage what the result will be. Well, no doubt by the time people are watching, you may have a better sense, but we don't know at the day. Is that fear itself part of the problem? A society not confident anymore in itself, the West not confident because it's been challenged within by other values?
That's an interesting question. I think that there is an element of that and what is especially concerning to me in the specific example that you've given is the lack of empathy towards one's fellow individual who may be from a different tribe seems the absolute antithesis of what liberalism or Western liberalism is supposed to stand for. So there is this question about whether, you know, does liberalism sort of eat itself from within, or does it leave itself open to being destroyed by the very,
or as one of my other guests said to me some time ago, does liberalism need to work within a nation that internationally it's a difficult thing?
Yeah.
Right, yes. Let me push back on this. Liberalism, not directly, liberal societies of that time, 18th to 19th and early 20th century, were also many cases colonial societies. And there's a sort of reckoning, whether it's overreaction, which I think may well be, but there's a sense in which the West has lost confidence because people are saying, look what you did.
Yes.
What do you say to that?
I think it's interesting on so many levels. I think that there does need to be some kind of confrontation in the sense that we've got to confront the fact that previously the Western civilization system model, or whatever you want to call it, did have this sort of paradox to it. Because yes, it was driven by freedom, it was driven by liberty, but it was also exploitation of certain groups.
It wasn't freedom for all.
At the same time.
It wasn't freedom for all. Yes, it was freedom for the English, but not the Africans. Exactly. Freedom for the American settlers, but not for the African slaves. Yeah. There's a certain paradox, blind spot, you think it is?
Definitely. And, just thinking about the example of how the spoils of aspects of the slave trade in turn enriched a English new middle class that was in turn able to fight for property rights and constitutional rights. So you see how the exploitation actually feeds a kind of liberty, which then feeds another kind of liberty. So it's very, very interesting from a historical viewpoint. It's very nuanced and very paradoxical. And so my point is that it's actually really important to think about that, because it isn't the next challenge surely to figure out then, so how do we amend this so that we can create a system in which there isn't any kind of exploitation, where everybody gets to be free? I'd have thought that that would be the next stage of evolution in the progress of Western society, and that so that doesn't have to descend into a complete abandonment of Western civilization, and saying that Western civilization is evil and is best left in the past.
And I think Hobbes said, "There's no commonwealth where its foundation is not, with hindsight, questionable." I've got the words to use. Because I agree with the West has a dark past as well as a good past, but so does every other civilization in the world. I don't know any other. There's not the pure and the bad. The West has the one rare capacity, which I think does come out of its Christian underpinnings, of self-reflection, self-criticism, which you don't, I may be overgeneralizing, but you may be able to correct me, which is not seen to be a product of the alternative cultural traditions.
Yeah.
And the danger is that going to eat us up or make us stronger?
Well, exactly. And there is an element of us not focusing on the future and obsessing about the past. And perhaps that's because we can't quite see a future, so it's easier in a way to talk about the past.
Well, while we get over it, I've always wondered, we sort of discovered, oh my God, we had slaves. Mm-hmm. So that's a trivial, I've got it. But my goodness me, there were slaves, blah, 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 blah. And let's deal with that, but let's not let it imprison us.
Yeah.
And after a while, this may be Forsyth's theory of boredom as a energy of progress.
Yeah.
We say, we're done with it, we can't endlessly obsess.
Yeah.
We'll move on. Do you think you think maybe you're seeing a moment that's worrying you, but the West will, as it has many times in the past, get past it?
Maybe. But sometimes I am shocked by how we can have the same arguments over and over and over again, and people don't seem to get tired of them. So maybe there's something in them that just, when they're never settled. I mean, with slavery as well, I don't think we've got to the bottom of what we can actually learn from slavery. I mean, slaves had a lot of wisdom in, from slavery about what freedom
is
and why freedom's important. And it's a shame that we've lost that. We've never really discussed that and allowed that to enrich our understanding of liberty today.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's also worth saying, if I may defend the West, slavery was taken as a take it for granted in every culture. It's taken obvious. It's just obvious that some people are inferior, some experience, Aristotle and others. That's just the way things are.
Yes.
But it was in the West, and only in the West, where a movement arose and said, that is not right. And slavery was actually abolished by the West in itself. Now, I know that doesn't clean the stain of the African slave trade or slave trade, but that itself is something.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? I mean, that was a great mode of moral achievement.
Yeah, and it's this sort of question of...
And that grew out of understanding not just of freedom, but but freedom in the context of equality, of respect for individuals.
Yes. And I think it also speaks to the fact that I think there are a lot of liberals, and even liberal philosophers, who had previously sort of been apologists for slavery. And you can see the tensions in their own thing, like people like Kant. And ultimately, I think slavery isn't compatible with liberal values. And in the end, it was liberal values that trumped that contradiction that was at the center of the society. And so I think it was a triumph in a way for what our true values are. And it was only a matter of time before slavery had to be abolished. And I think there are people who say, well, it happened for economic reasons. It was that it was no longer, you know, economically.
I don't think that's true at all.
Yeah, no, I'm saying
when you say our true values, do you believe that there is a true set of fundamental value of humanity, and that all the rest are sort of artificial, or are you more is liberalism, you're saying, natural to human beings?
I think freedom is just a natural.
Do you really?
I think there's a. Yeah, I do. I don't know.
Well, I'm thinking.
I can quite articulate why I think that, but I think that there is something about the human condition which is just anchored in freedom. We are autonomous human beings. We're also languaging beings. We're also collaborative.
But we're also social beings. Massively. Yes. I mean, very much tribalism exists.
Yes. But in some societies, right, I'm thinking about, we should go back to slavery. I mean, the freedom and the family are one, right? I think even freedom, there's something about that the word, the etymology of the word, it means going back to the mother. So there is something about freedom. Freedom isn't necessarily individualism. It can also be about what happens when people...
Well, let me put it this way. Freedom for what? It's just freedom for arbitrary choice.
Yeah.
That's not... I mean, that's a tyranny. Is there, like, there must be a sense of what humans are for to flourish.
Exactly.
In the concept of freedom.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that this is actually one of the big weaknesses that needs to be rectified. We need to start asking ourselves, freedom for what?
Yes.
I think we've become quite frightened of asking that question. And again, it goes back to this Isaac Berlin Cold War liberalism that you should be careful about being for something, because if you're for something, then you're implying that that's worth sacrificing for, and that's a dangerous revolutionary kind of freedom. The revolutionary freedom of Rousseau, which is what we don't want.
No, we don't want that.
So, but I mean, the problem with not having something that you're for is that then you're always on the defensive.
But one of the troubles with, the reality of liberalism, it brackets the great questions of the answers, the great questions of life. It doesn't decide what the good life is. It allows society, and this means it's limited in a way of what freedom is for, because that's another place.
Yeah.
By cutting off its metaphysical or religious underpinnings, because I myself believe that many of the great values of freedom and equality are the roots of the slow working through Western society of the Christian faith, we think it's true or not.
Yeah.
I'm thinking historically, not theologically here. And I'm wondering whether there's a kind of that's losing its power over our culture. So we're going back to a much more Nietzschean, a world in which the ancients did believe people were not equal. The ancients did believe violence was okay. Yeah. The ancients did discount human life.
Yeah.
A kind of re-paganizing the way some have said.
Does
that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And funnily enough, I think we even see that in film, by the way.
Yes.
I'm really interested in how the cowboy movies, which are really, they're the ordinary heroes of the West. I mean, that's what
the West is
so amazing about
both senses, yes.
They're sort of, the knights of, the Arthurian knights, but they are popular.
They are the restorers
of
order.
They are true populist, rugged individualists. And how those movies have gone really out of fashion, and we are left with these superhero movies, and it's kind of this celebration of elite.
All right.
The super elite. I mean, it's very Nietzschean. If you look at Hollywood today, it's totally Nietzschean. And even in advertising, by the way, so something like Nike, which they are famous for their libertarian advertising slogan, just do it. Just
Well, it depends what the it is, it might.
But now it's find your greatness.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it's all this thing you do, it's kind of middle class, shrinking middle class who feels perhaps diminished somehow. And, you know, advertising is all about
show.
Messianism now.
I've always been troubled by the fact that many charities don't say care, they say show that you care.
Showing, yes.
In other words, caring as performance.
Yes, yes.
Not as actually having compassion for people needed. Right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yes. Now, what hope is there? I mean, we're now in the depths of despair. Not quite, but
yeah.
And you are working on possibility of the rejuvenation. What from your experience do you think are the possible areas of rejuvenation? What hope is there, Cheryl?
I think that the current economic stagnation, for example, that is something which could be overcome. It is a lag in the system as we move from a society that's powered by mass production to one that's powered by mass thought, in a way, because it's the knowledge economy, digital fueled. And so if we can actually navigate that properly and understand the things that we need to do in order to achieve that, then I think we do have a new era of superabundance upon us. It's just that I feel a little skeptical about whether we understand what needs to be done. And when you see governments that are actually quite nostalgic and talking about industrial plans rather than about the knowledge economy, is not particularly encouraging. So there's that. There's the fact that this isn't the end, that there is, you know, another phase of civilization to come. And that actually I find quite heartening and quite exciting. What else is there to be upbeat about?
I'm not sure. Oh dear. Well, it may be, in fact, that by the very nature of these things, you can't see. I was thinking again, I went back to the 1920s and 30s. The 1920s, the end of the Great War, and of course the Great Plague of the Spanish flu. And if you'd asked someone in the 1930s, Stalin supreme, all the intellectuals guy over to him, you know, Hitler, the strong man, you'd think, well, there's not much hope really.
Yeah.
And yet it was followed by a decade of remarkable growth of liberty. Now, it may be on the recline again, but there was, I think the great hope is that history is plainly unpredictable.
Yeah.
I say that.
Yeah, there's actually one other thing that I can think of that I am potentially encouraged by. And I think some of the things that are happening in the American Rust Belt and the lessons that are coming out of that, that people who are pro-freedom could learn from in terms of how do you rejuvenate Rust Belts, areas that have been left behind, where you do have this populist sentiment, which is becoming anti-globalist, anti-capitalist. So recently I went on a trip to the Rust Belt and I went to towns like Grand Rapids and South Bend. And I think they've really cracked how you turn towns which have been left behind around. And it's how they, it's a long slog. It's things like infrastructure. It's things like making your centers attractive for young people to come, artists and creative people. It's about creating clusters of innovation. And if we can just crack that formula and apply that across Western societies where you do have this very influential belt of individuals who feel like they have been left behind, like capitalism hasn't worked for them, then that would be game changing.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We need to go on. I think the one answer is history is never in a straight line.
Yes.
Cheryl Jacobs, thank you so much for joining me. This has been Rob Forsyth and Liberalism in Question. Thanks for watching.
If you enjoy this content, please consider joining us by becoming a member of CIS. You'll be part of Australia's growing movement towards free markets, individual liberty, cultural freedom, and a limited government. Join today at cis.org.au/membership.